WashingTech. Techno-chauvinists will try and use technology even when technology is not the appropriate answer.
Welcome to the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed on the move in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
Joe Miller.
Google is under fire for training facial recognition technology on dark-skinned homeless people. How do companies like Google balance between having a diverse database and using dubious tactics to obtain that data? Also, is Facebook enabling the Trump campaign again? And Meredith Broussard is my guest. Hey, everybody. The New York Daily News reports that Google apparently sent out contractors to train facial recognition on dark-skinned homeless people. The revelation comes after several former Google temp workers came forward. Google has acknowledged the program, though, and said its primary goal is to have a diverse and inclusive data set. Better security is also a goal, said the Google spokesperson, because the company is seeking to protect as many people as possible. But the workers took issue with some of the specific tactics they were asked to employ via their staffing agency, Randstad, under the direction of Google, such as paying homeless people with $5 gift cards in exchange for their images. More in the Daily News. The CEO of the Democratic National Committee, Seema Nanda, went on CNN last week and accused Facebook of catering to Trump by allowing him to mislead the American people, end quote. The previous week, Facebook refused to remove posts and ads from politicians, even if they violate Facebook's community rules. Also, Scott Lucas at BuzzFeed wrote a piece on Facebook's growing popularity among older and more conservative voters, and whether Facebook may in fact be Trump's secret weapon against Democrats in the 2020 election. In a letter to Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, Senator Kamala Harris, who is running for president, called on Twitter to suspend Trump's Twitter account, citing the president's attempt to, quote, target, harass, and attempt to out the first Ukraine whistleblower, end quote. She also referred to the president's tweet stating that there would be a civil war-like fracture if he's impeached, saying it was an incitement to violence. The president also referred to the impeachment investigation as a coup, to which Harris retweeted with a comment saying, hey, Jack, time to do something about this. But Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Tulsi Gabbard, both of whom are also running for president, disagreed that Twitter should suspend the president's Twitter account. The two lawmakers said that, quote, we can't just cancel or shut down or silence those who we disagree with or who hold different views or who say things even that we strongly disagree with or abhor. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the FCC's 2017 repeal of the 2015 net neutrality rules. The court sided with the FCC in saying that the internet isn't a telecommunications service. It was a mixed opinion, though. The court said that the FCC didn't make a compelling argument that the FCC preempts state law. This clears the way for states to enact their own net neutrality rules, provided that they don't undermine the repeal order. The court also said the FCC failed to properly consider the effect the rules would have on public safety, serving the underserved and a wonky area of telecom law that deals with regulations around how ISPs should attach telecom equipment to existing telephone poles. The Department of Homeland Security has proposed a rule that would allow the widespread collection of DNA from detained migrants. The Trump administration argues that the effort would aid the U.S. in identifying undocumented individuals, but policy experts cited in Roll Call are concerned that the program is just another way to target people of color. Tim Cook filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court urging the court to protect the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program. If the Supreme Court rules against the program, hundreds of thousands of individuals who arrived in the U.S. as children, some of which work at Apple, could face deportation. Google researchers presented a model that recognizes speech in 9 data-scarce Indian languages at Interspeech 2019 last week. The researchers say the model allows for real-time speech recognition of all of the languages and does so better than other models. The languages include Hindi, Marathi, Urdu, Bengali, Tamil, Telugu, Kannada, Malayalam, and Gujarati. The House Financial Services Committee, for which California Representative Maxine Waters serves as chair, is demanding that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testify regarding his plan to introduce Facebook's Libra cryptocurrency. The company has planned to send COO Sheryl Sandberg, but the committee indicated that sending Sandberg is insufficient. Waters has called for Zuckerberg to testify by January. Microsoft reported a hacking attempt linked to Iran on 2,700 email accounts, of which 241 were successful. Some of the accounts included presidential candidates, according to The Hill, which also noted that an undisclosed source indicated that the Trump campaign was among the targets. The Trump campaign has said that it does not have any evidence of an attack. Finally, the Federal Aviation Administration has approved UPS's plan to operate an unlimited fleet of drones nationwide. The drones are permitted to operate at night, but not yet in populated areas. UPS has not announced plans to train existing drivers to pilot the drones. And you can find links to all these stories in the show notes and also in our Twitter feed. And our handle is at WashingTech. Stay with us.
Inclusive voice of tech policy, Washing Tech. We see you.
My guest today is data journalist Meredith Broussard. Dr. Broussard is an associate professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute of New York University and the author of Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. Her academic research focuses on artificial intelligence and investigative reporting. She's an affiliate faculty member at the Moore Sloan Data Science Environment at the NYU Center for Data Science, a 2019 Reynolds Journalism Institute Fellow, and her work has been supported by the Institute of Museum and Library Services, as well as the Toe Center at Columbia University. A former features editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer, she has also worked as a software developer at AT&T Bell Labs and at the MIT Media Lab. Please welcome Meredith Broussard. Meredith, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a book recently entitled Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. And in it, you approach the issue of AI bias from the vantage point of having been a computer scientist, but becoming more disillusioned, I guess is the best word, with the potential for technology. You write that the optimism surrounding technology seems sort of overwrought. What made you change your mind from optimism to skepticism?
Well, I started my career as a computer scientist, and I quit to become a journalist. And the primary reason that I quit was that I couldn't hack the sexism in the computer science industry. So I went over to journalism, where it's not like there isn't sexism, but it's less rampant. Journalism is a better industry in which to be a woman. And so when you are treated really badly by an industry, you sort of start looking for, you just stop believing the hype. And there's a lot of hype in tech. There are a lot of promises about artificial intelligence, and those promises rarely, if ever, come true. And you can kind of only hear the promises so many times before you start losing faith.
What's the difference, in your view, between how the public views technology and how computer scientists view it?
I think that there's a really big gap between what the public thinks technology can do and what computer scientists know that technology can do. So one of the things I read about in the book is an idea that I call techno-chauvinism. And this is a kind of bias that says that technology is superior to, say, human decision-making or human processes. And techno-chauvinists will try and use technology even when technology is not the appropriate answer. So what I argue is that it's not a competition, that really we should be thinking about what is the right tool for the task? Because sometimes the right tool for the task is something sophisticated like a computer. And then other times it's something simple like a book in the hands of a child sitting on its parent's lap, right? One is not better than the other. It's really about what's appropriate. So somehow in the past 20 years or so, we have gotten into this this reflexive kind of bias where we think, oh, let's use technology for everything. So I would encourage people to step back and be more measured and considered about when it is and is not appropriate to use technology. And part of that is understanding what technology can and cannot do. So as a computer scientist, I can look at a computer program and I can look at the claims that are being made about that computer program and I can say, oh, well, that claim is not validated by the computer program. But if you don't actually know how computers work, you know, on a really, if you're not super familiar with how they work, then it's easy to get drawn in by grand marketing claims.
You also wrote in your book about how AI and machine learning bias impacts standardized test scores and leads to standardized test disparities. Explain that for us. What's the connection there?
So this section of the book came about because I was working on a story about standardized tests in public schools. And I asked the question, do Philadelphia public school students have all of the materials that they would need in order to learn the material that's on the state-mandated standardized tests? All right, so there are a lot of specifics in that question. I asked this question because I was curious about why Philadelphia had never been able to get more than 50% of its students to pass the state-mandated standardized tests. Because I'm a professor, like I know how these things go, and I also used to teach. I used to tutor for standardized tests, so I know that there are these methods that you can use to get kids to do better on the tests. I also knew that the same people who write the tests write the books that you use to prepare for the tests, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because when you think about how do you study for a test, well, you go over the material that your teacher gave you in class, right? And you go through the readings and you work on the problem sets. And teachers don't test their students on material that hasn't been introduced in class. Right. So when you look at a standardized test, you can look at it and say, OK, well, what do you need to know in order to pass this test? And so I originally thought that I was going to be able to make some sort of like high tech, beat the test kind of strategy thing. And it turns out you don't need that. The only thing you need to do to pass these tests, Pennsylvania standardized tests, is you need to read the book. That's it. But Philadelphia public schools didn't have the books that the students would need. Most of the schools did not have sufficient books. And furthermore, they didn't have enough money in their budgets to buy the books, even if they wanted to. So they had plenty of money for buying technology that would be implemented in kind of spotty ways, but they didn't have enough money for books. This was in all schools. So the problems that you see in Philadelphia public schools are the same problems that you see in every other large urban school district in the United States. They don't have enough money, period. And their facilities are not in any kind of shape. So a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, why are we still buying books in this day and age? Why haven't we gone to giving every student a laptop or, you know, doing everything on iPads? And there are some very practical reasons for why we haven't done that. So one thing is that large urban public schools often don't have air conditioning. So in Philadelphia, when the temperature goes over 100 degrees, they close the schools. And the schools are really, really hot, and you can't use computers in really hot environments because they don't work. Right? So if you've ever like tried to use your laptop on a sunny day in the summertime, well, your laptop will overheat very quickly. So you'd need to put in air conditioning in the schools in order to use the computers. Well, in order to put in air conditioning, you need to redo the electrical grid. And you also need to redo the electrical grid in order to plug in 30 laptops simultaneously, because that also draws a lot of power. And the schools don't have the money in the budget to put in the air conditioning or redo the electrical, right? It all comes back to money.
How does techno-chauvinism cause us to overlook algorithmic biases? What are some examples?
Well, one example that I'm really concerned about is self-driving cars. So techno-chauvinists make a lot of claims about self-driving cars and what it's going to be like in the future when cars drive themselves. And the reality of self-driving cars is very, very different from what the marketers would have you believe. So one thing that is a clue to this is that until this past year, you only saw positive media coverage of self-driving cars, and you only saw positive mentions, and you only saw like the same two or three things that people would say about the future of self-driving cars. Now, when you have so many people saying exactly the same thing, that's usually an indicator that there is a marketing campaign at work, that it's not necessarily the truth, that it's being managed somehow. So one of the things that I do in the book is I go for a ride in a self-driving car. And I kind of show what is the man behind the curtain. Like, what is it really doing? What kind of data are these sensors taking in? And what is the potential for loss of human life? And so I'm not at all optimistic about self-driving cars. I think there are definitely some advances that have been made in automotive technology in the past couple of years, but I don't think that we're eventually going to have a future where cars drive themselves.
So what are two or three questions that policymakers should be asking themselves as they develop legislation, and how would you advise them about the things they should be doing to answer those questions?
So I would advise policymakers to do a deep dive into how technology actually works. So one of the reasons that I wrote this book is because I wanted there to be a plain language explanation of really sophisticated technical concepts. So you have to understand the technology in order to make good policy around technology. So for a very long time, the people who make technology have been getting away with all kinds of stuff because they've been able to say, oh, well, it's technology you wouldn't understand. And policymakers have said, oh, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't understand. It's technology. It's too complicated. And it is complicated. Like, it does take some effort, but the effort is worth it. And it is crucial to understand how these things work, and also what is the potential impact on our democracy.
Well, Meredith, thanks so much for joining me. Your book is serious, but very funny in some parts, and I laughed a lot. Laughed with you, of course, so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Now let's turn to your icebreaker, your best career advice you've ever received, and hear about what you're reading, watching, and listening to these days. Okay, so it's time for this week's icebreaker. If you could rid the world of one thing, what would it be?
Techno-chauvinism.
There you go. All right. What's the best piece of career advice you've ever received?
The best piece of career advice I think I've ever received was at a talk when I was working at AT&T Bell Labs when I was young. And the person got up there and said, okay, I want you to write down what you imagine your life to be like 5 years from now. And so we all wrote it down. And then they said, use what you just wrote down as a guideline for making that happen, for making your life, for making concrete steps to make your life the way you imagine it to be.
So did you implement those?
Yeah. So I wrote down what I wanted my life to be like. And then I thought, oh, yeah, I could do those things. And then I did them. And it was fun.
Nice. So what are you reading and watching and listening to these days?
Reading, I can recommend Sophia Noble's book, Algorithms of Oppression, and also Ruha Benjamin's book, Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code.
Sophia was actually on the show.
Oh, fantastic. She's great.
Yeah, she is. Well, thanks again, Meredith, for joining me. Do you have any final ideas you'd like to leave with us before we close? And where can we find you online?
You can find me online at MeredithBroussard.com, and you can check out the book, Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World, anywhere the books are sold.
And you've been listening to Meredith Broussard, NYU professor and author of Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. Meredith, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
That concludes episode 204 of the podcast. Thanks so much to all of you for listening. If you like what we do here, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts, give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. We also have a weekly newsletter that you can join. And joining it gives you access to exclusive announcements, events, and our insider network. More details about that once you subscribe. And you can find that on our website at techpolicypodcast.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.
Washing Tech.